Namaste, as I bow to you. Professor P here. This is POSCOM Talks Prevention Science. We will get into the interesting fact of the day, and then we will have our special guest, Dr. Tansy Vandekar Burden. The interesting fact of the day. It's going to be love, the concept of love, or the definition of love. That is the interesting fact of the day. Now, for my great friend and mentor, Bill, we're not talking about a score of 0, as in tennis. Love 40. Funny to me, you can love playing tennis and be losing. 40 love. Does this mean you have double doses of love? All right, let's begin with definitions, shall we? Now, as a doctoral candidate, my dissertation is in APA style, or the American Psychological Association 7th edition. The guidelines approve 2 dictionary sources, which are the Merriam-Webster.com dictionary and the APA Dictionary of Psychology. We'll do the Merriam-Webster dictionary. So here are the definitions for the word love. The first, and this is 1A. Love, strong affection for another arising out of kinship or personal ties. The description they have is maternal love for a child, motherly love. 1B, right after motherly love, we have attraction based on sexual desire, affection and tenderness felt by lovers. The description, after all these years, they are still very much in love. Maybe a quick rant. I find it funny that the first definition and its description of maternal love or motherly love are pretty much indescribable, to me anyway. It's the closest to God love, and I would assume my trying to compare anything to God love would be blasphemous. But this love is of such strong affection for another that it is described as maternal. The second definition, attraction, is based on a sexual desire, affection, and tenderness felt by lovers, with the description, after all these years, they are very much in love. The concept of love knows no boundaries, as the first 2 definitions take us from maternal, motherly love, the closest to unconditional love you can get, and then attraction based on sexual desire, the affection and tenderness felt by lovers. Okay, back to more definitions of love. Affection based on admiration or common interests, love for his schoolmates, an assurance of affection, warm attachment, enthusiasm, or devotion. There was love for the sea, the object of attachment, devotion, or admiration. Baseball was his first love, a beloved person, often used as a term of endearment, especially British. Hello, love. The 4th definition, even though it sounded like we had 6 there, because there were some A's and B's, but number 4 is unselfish, loyal, and positive, genuine concern for the good of another, such as the fatherly concern of God for humankind, or like Springsteen's "On the streets of Philadelphia," a brotherly love, concern for others. A person's adoration of God, love. Moving on, a god such as Cupid, Eros, or personification of love. Number 6, an amorous episode, love affair. And number 7, the sexual embrace, copulation. As a transitive verb, to love is to cherish, to fondle, to copulate, to thrive, and to take pleasure in. So, as we see, the definition and description of love encompasses so much. It shows just how difficult, complex, or intricate the human language is to describe such a feeling. And vice versa, maybe it shows how simple, foolish, and unenlightened or understanding we are. I will try to avoid the Freudian Oedipus complex because Freud was known to be intoxicated throughout his life. Rousseau's 2011 Psychology, Giants on Coke, suggests Foy began using cocaine as a young researcher in the early 1880s, and at that time, it was considered a miracle drug. Like most addicts, Foy's access to large quantities of the drug and his attempts to covertly hide his usage put a strain on his relationships and his mental health. Either way, the definition of love is illustrated first as maternal or motherly love, and then moves into an attraction based on the lover's affair. Love takes on the following connotations: admire, attach, devote, adore, and then back to the sexual embrace, affair, and copulation. For me, there seems to be this line in the sand with love, as it is unconditional, not God unconditional, but motherly unconditional, and then it is conditional in the fact that there's got to be reciprocation, at least in that second definition. Also, there doesn't have to be reciprocation, and love can take on the obsessive lust or give me, I want, I need aspect. I elect to accept the following definition as an accurate portrayal that love is an unselfish, loyal, positive, genuine, honest concern for the good of another, such as the fatherly concern of God for humankind, or like Springsteen's Streets of Philadelphia. By the way, fathers can love motherly, though the biological maternal phenomena of carrying an embryo, then fetus, to the birth of the child cannot be emulated by the father. On the contrary, mothers can also lack empathy and disassociate themselves from their children, which may hold resonance and support why that maternal motherly love comes first in the definition of description. Ralph Few, or Father John Doe, also known as the first Catholic priest of Alcoholics Anonymous, said that love is an action. Love is sacrifice. I truly believe this. The concept of prevention science comes from service and love, two principles that Dr. Bob Smith, one of the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, revered as the most important legacies of the fellowship, love and service. In fact, to say, I love you, in its most authentic form, one should remove the ego identifiers of I and you. Hence, it would just be love. Like the late but forever great Bob Marley, grasp this concept. One love. That was the interesting fact of the day. Love. And of course, speaking of love, we do have Dr. Tansy Vandekar Burden here in the studio.
I am Tansy Vandekar Burden. I am director of the Social Science Research Center at Old Dominion University in the College of Arts and Letters. I've been with the center since it started in 1998, first as the associate director, and I was there.
Awesome. You've been with Old Dominion that long?
Yes. Actually, even before that, I was here as a master's student for my master's in applied sociology. Went out real world for a little bit and then came back to work at the center. It was newly started. I don't know if you want me to talk about that.
And, well, applied sociologist, more criminal.
Yes, right? It was applied sociology with an emphasis in criminal justice. My bachelor's degree is in criminal justice that I obtained in upstate New York, where I'm originally from. Kind of had that criminology thread through at least my earlier academic career, yes.
And then coming back here and doing your PhD, that's public policy.
Yeah, public administration and urban policy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so was that something when you went out into the real world and working, you were like, I want to, you know, do that or change, or did ODU not have a...
So when I got my master's degree, I graduated and I was a magistrate for the city of Norfolk, working in the criminal justice system for real. Yeah. And it was great experience, but also eye-opening. And when Dr. Carol Seifert approached me about coming back to the university to help with the start of the Social Science Research Center, or the SSRC, I didn't have any intentions of getting a doctoral degree, worked with the center. We had a director, obviously he had his PhD, and he finally came to me. I don't know, it was probably, you know, I started in this position in 1998. It was probably late 99, early 2000, that he said, you know, the university will help pay for your degree.
Right.
You, and he didn't say it this way, but basically he was saying it'd be kind of dumb if you didn't take advantage of that opportunity and get a PhD, because it would help the center. We'd have two people on staff with doctoral degrees. So that I was like, okay. I knew it would benefit me personally and professionally. It was not really on my radar screen necessarily. And OU at that time did not have the doctoral degree in criminology that they now have. So I was looking around at various programs, and the public administration and urban policy was kind of practitioner focused. And we worked with so many like state and local agencies, nonprofits, that kind of thing, that it seemed like a pretty good fit. It was kind of broad enough that my director and I at the time thought it would be kind of a good, stable PhD that would serve me well, but also have relevance to the work that you're doing at the center. Yeah, I mean, it took me probably 6 to 7 years to get it done, but yeah, I got it done while working full time.
PhD.
It's a PhD, that's right. It's behind my name and no one can take it away at this point.
And, you know, you're like not on my radar. Speaking of radar, because we had talked about this prevention science.
Mm-hmm.
Had you or have you ever heard of prevention science?
Well, I certainly hadn't. I don't think I had heard much about it until you came and worked with us here at the center. And I still don't know a ton about it, but it sounds like in this evolving world of better understanding mental health needs, addiction, trauma, it seems something that's definitely needed and valuable in terms of understanding the risk and protective factors. People who are in situations, they're natural or nurtured, that are
right.
not natural or not nurtured, or vice versa. You know, how can we support people in the best ways to perhaps have better outcomes and maybe prevent some of those, prevent the risk factors from happening and build up our protective factors.
Your research throughout your career, do you see this prevention work? Could you?
I mean, possibly. I think possibly. I think prevention in the sense of understanding some of, you know, what's the status quo? You know, what are people thinking? A lot of the work that we do here, the center, is just understanding public opinion, right, about quality of life, for example, here in Hampton Roads, experiences of people in certain situations. And so if you have at least that baseline knowledge of here's the status quo and what's wrong with the status quo, then I think you can use that to then say, oh, here's some gaps. Here's where people need help. Here's where people are not doing well. I mean, I think in that kind of very generic term, you could call it prevention. Some of the work that we've done recently that I'm very excited about is looking at a very specific population of Alzheimer's caregivers, people that they've got a job as a teacher or, you know, a mailman or this kind of thing, but they have an elderly parent, but they have someone that they are caring for, almost another job on top of their real quote unquote job. And the risks that they face, not only socially, emotionally, mentally, physically, but things like cybercrime. We did a study because it was coming out of the pandemic, that not only were Alzheimer's people who were caring for someone with Alzheimer's more likely to be victimized during COVID due to cybercrime, but they lost more and they lost more money.
Yes.
And so, you know, what's so special? What, you know, I think we need to look at that group, because that group is going to be growing as, you know, the number of people, as we live longer, we're going to have issues like Alzheimer's is going to become more common. And so you're going to have more and more people that are trying to help loved ones care for them. And so what is it that we need to be focusing on this population that's going to be caring for potentially our oldest segment of the population? So in that way, I can kind of see that being prevention. Like how do we, you know, what are the needs of this very specific group, and how do we prevent them from having their own health crises, their own mental health crises, their own financial crises, and becoming victims of crime and other types of.
The program too, that this prevention,
mm-hmm.
for example, and I'm skipping a question. I have questions here for Tansy, but we're going to skip some of this and go into the term grant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as a gift. I mean, you're held accountable.
Yes.
And you get a grant. I would like to hear about how many grants the SSRC has accumulated since 1999, because that's like we're taught that in our how important it is to assess the community and then capacity. We have to get people or support or stakeholders, and you have ODU and your connections. Tell me about this. I mean, because what, 25 years of grant?
Yes, yes. So a lot of our work is grant. Grants, a lot of it are contracts too, that we contract with like the State Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services to do research or data collection for them in areas of prevention or early intervention services for young children, that kind of thing. I think I was trying to run the numbers and I felt like I probably got interrupted, but I mean, we've had to have had, even if we just had 4 a year, that would be 100 in 25 years, right? So we've had hundreds of grants and contracts to do various types of data collection, some in partnership with other ODU faculty, some that the center took on as our own work. And so that's, you know, millions of dollars. And then there's other grants where faculty, you know, they've got their own research agenda. They've got their own data collection needs that they need. And we kind of just tagged on and helped them a little bit. And so there, you know, that little piece of that, you know, came to us to help support their data collection needs.
Is there added pressure with a grant? And even if you know, you know, it's like when we'll get into Life in Hampton Roads, something that you've done now 14, 15 years,
mm-hmm.
right? Is there still added pressure that you're getting a grant and you're expected to deliver specific, measurable, achievable results?
Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, our work, whether it's a grant or a contract, there's typically a scope of work. There's specific deliverables that we have to produce. There's typically a deadline or multiple deadlines, like, you know, this has to be achieved by this date. We need the data by this date. We need a report by this date. Those kind of, you know, built in, you know, I don't want to call them pressures, but, you know, they're obligations and deadlines. In terms of the work that the center does, in terms of our staffing, pretty much most of our folks, if they're not funded by the university on assistantship, they're funded by the grants and contracts that we get. So there is that pressure. We've got to keep producing and bringing in more funding to keep the people that are working with us employed.
Right.
So, and we've been very fortunate, had Wendy, who's been here almost as long as I have, we've been able to keep her, you know, fully employed with benefits for 20 plus years, you know, and so that's been awesome.
Wendy had reminded me that Old Dominion University is, well, we're a number one research, like Carnegie.
R1, yeah.
Right?
R1.
And
mm-hmm.
I mean, SSRC is, I mean, that's a big part. And the quality of life study, Hampton Roads, it's a pretty big deal. And I mean, it's a big deal. You're on the news. And it's important that, like, when you were like, okay, yeah, we want to keep people paid, but it's important research.
Well, I mean, I think so, but of course I would think that. But yeah, so the Life in Hampton Roads survey this year will be 15 years. Quality of life survey of residents living in the seven cities of Hampton Roads. So that's Virginia Beach, Norfolk, Chesapeake, Newport News, Hampton, Suffolk, and I'm forgetting one.
Did you say Bobby?
Virginia Beach. Goodness, I live there.
And I'm going to try to show my expertise. Estimates about 2.5 million people. It's a big
area. Yeah. So we've been doing this mostly telephone during COVID. That changed a little bit, but mostly telephone survey of residents for 15 years to find out, like, hey, what's it like to live here? How's the quality of life? What do you think about the schools? What are some of the issues? You know, do you have concerns about traffic congestion? Does your neighborhood flood? Do you have flood insurance? You know, how's your health? What do you think about the healthcare? This 2023, we asked questions about, you know, difficulties, financial difficulties around paying rent and mortgage. What do you think about affordable housing? So yeah, so it gives that kind of snapshot of what people are thinking. Like, we have tons and tons of kind of existing institutional, you know, pre-collected data from census and economic indicators and all that. And that's all very important. But what do people think about? What are they struggling? You know, one of the interesting examples that I always use is researchers here at the university and elsewhere, there's some consensus that sea levels are rising, right? And Norfolk is an area where it is very prone to flooding. And their estimates said this is just going to keep occurring.
Because my wife keeps telling me it's bulls.
Yeah.
That is why our yard is. But Yes, it has.
Yes. And so, but yet in the how many years that we've been doing the survey, the percentage of people who report having flood insurance has hardly moved at all from 33%.
Right.
So it's like, well, what needs to happen for people to be like, you know what, I might need to protect my home and my property, and this one might be one way to do it. Now, there's all other kinds of things. That's just one example. Yeah, but
I mean, I remember the, I mean, ideals or perspective about police.
Yes.
Was even, I mean, and a hot topic at the time too, yes. Which,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've, you know, the perceptions of the police are fairly positive, but if you start breaking that down by certain target demographic groups and or by city. So I think that's important for policymakers, educators, decision makers to know that. And I think it's important for all of us to know, like, I have my lived experience and I have my opinions about what it's like to live here, but that's not what everybody thinks. You know, there's a variety of opinions, and we need to understand the diversity of experience. And even though our region is wonderful and great, many opportunities, many, many positive things, but there's some real struggles here too.
Yeah, I agree. How has the methods of getting your research, now they're definitely quantitative, but you also do focus group, so it's a mixed method with the life at Hampton Roads, but a lot of your projects are
mixed methods.
Methodology.
Yeah. So yeah, life at Hampton Roads is pretty much, you know, very much quantitative, you know, even though we're talking to people over the phone, the data is sort of organizing that by numbers. So caregiver project that I talked about earlier, Alzheimer's caregivers, we started doing interviews and focus groups with caregivers, qualitative open-ended discussions about what it was like to do caregiving and be a caregiver during the pandemic when you used to be able to go out, or maybe the person you care for, you could have someone else and come in and care for them for a little while. Well, during the pandemic, that wasn't happening.
Exactly.
So we kind of started with this qualitative approach just to kind of understand what were the challenges, what were the experiences. Were people who typically may not have been living in the online world were now kind of forced into the online world, and how do they feel about that? And did they feel vulnerable? And there was definitely, from the people we talked to, they definitely felt vulnerable. That then informed a larger statewide survey, a more quantitative survey of the general public, but trying to focus on older adults and particularly those who are caregivers about their experiences and with cybercrime and with, you know, during the pandemic. And so that was an example of how we started out qualitative, ended up quantitative, and, you know, we have some really rich data.
I want you to reflect back with your thesis in mixed methods. Well, I mean, it's done correctly. When it's done right and you can bring both sides together, I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
Did you initially, your early studies, were you more quant? Were you qualitative? Or have you always had this mixed methods in your bag?
So my thesis was quantitative. I was looking at victim-offender relationship and the setting of bail. So when, you know, what if victims and offenders know each other, does the bail amount differ?
It just makes my stomach, like, I didn't realize those, you know, and then the magistrate, and then, you know, again, some of the things we didn't talk about, like assessment preparedness for sexual violence victims in 2006, domestic violence. Like, I mean, that was some hardcore.
Yeah. Yeah. I think both my thesis and my dissertation were mostly, but my dissertation was a statewide comparative study of nursing home quality of life regulations, and basically looking to see were states going above and beyond what the feds required for quality of life in nursing homes? The kind of, were they above the floor? You know, all these factors that had been determined to be significant in other studies of statewide differences in policy, hardly any of them were significant. And I'm like, what is going on? And then I realized if I had maybe done some interviews with people who were setting these policies or looking at kind of the context of the state, like there was one state who their policies were much higher. Their regulations were much higher than the fed's kind of threshold. But they had, you know, a legislator or someone who had this big push for end of life care. But yeah. I wasn't going to collect that in any of my quantitative data going through this, looking at regulations.
Yeah.
I think that to me was just another reinforcer of the fact that, yes, quantitative is important. Yes, qualitative is important, but you don't get the whole picture with just one or the other often, you know, a little bit of both to get as full a picture as possible.
Looking back again, and we'll spring forward, you know, because I know your daughter's a student here, Wendy's
thought as a student here, thinking about your biggest supporters of your career and maybe those that helped you with qualitative study too. Does anyone come to mind? And it doesn't have to be like, you know, career. I mean, it can just be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Wendy has been phenomenal as a colleague, as a friend, a dear, dear friend. And, you know, she, as much as anybody, you know, has helped the SSRC be what it is and be the success that it has been. And so I can't speak enough about her and my gratitude for her commitment to what we're doing here. In terms of supporters, I mean, my husband, I was working full time and then decided to start this PhD, got pregnant with our daughter.
Right.
And he was taking her to movies while I'm studying for comprehensive exam.
I'm laughing because they're from Northeast. So during that time, I mean, he had it made.
Well, yeah, the football was good. The football was good in the early, the 2000s through the 2019. I mean, I was going to classes at night. And so, I mean, I could not have done any of that without having a massively, amazingly supportive partner in my life. Dr. Carol Seifert, who is unfortunately no longer with us. She was a professor here at ODU in sociology. I worked for her as a master's student. She had a lot of research in the educational and occupational aspirations of rural youth. And so she did survey research on the Eastern Shore. She did a lot of survey research in Alaska. I actually got the opportunity to go to Alaska twice as a master's student and present to high school students in rural bush Alaska.
Yes.
Like you have to take a little flight, you know, right. From wherever to these little villages and amazing, amazing experiences. And so, you know, I worked for her as a master's student on assistantship. And then I graduated, went out, was a magistrate. And she was the one that, you know, convinced the college and the university, you know, what the College of Arts and Letters needs a research center, and we need to figure out what that is. And so they did a national search for a director, and she came to me and said, you know what, we need an associate director. I don't know if you have a job in a year. We don't know if the center's going to take off. What's going to happen? Do you think this is something you might want to do? And I was like, sure. You know, this is research. It's something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so she had provided so many opportunities for me as a student and as a professional that would not be the center, and we would not be here right now. She's an amazing woman, an amazing scholar. So yeah, those are people that come to mind. Here at the university, you know, we have a university women's caucus. They are major supporters of women scholars and women academics, women administrative and professional faculties, and they've been a major support and lifeline for me as well.
Yes, and I know that you were you had recently received an award. You know, your service is valuable and it's very, and to me, and I don't know if people know this little podcast for Wilmington, but the start of my program was an internship here with Tansy and Wendy. And then now as I get about to be a candidate in a few weeks, I get to top it off with you. And so is there anything else that you would, you know, especially maybe
someone that is,
especially, you know, a woman, it's looking to go for a PhD specifically in sociology, criminal, and public policy. I think they all work together. Is there anything that you might want to throw out there to give some?
Be prepared for challenges. Life brings you many challenges. I think we have to be super women. We have to be the best wife, the best mother, the best professional, and you will have guilt across all of those realms. Have a good partner in life that will help you navigate that. Have a good support system. Look for mentors that can help you through this. I've had some amazing mentors. I talked about Dr. Carol Seifert, also Dr. Mona Danner and Dr. Ruth Triplett, amazing mentors and friends. But also make sure you mentor them. You know, make sure you bring that next person up with you. When you go up, bring others up with you. And I think that's important for men and women, but I think particularly for women. Share your successes, you know, yourselves. And, you know, give yourself grace. Give yourself grace that, you know, something might slip in one area. You know, the adage, unless it's fatal, it's no big deal. I don't know if that's really true, but sometimes you got to tell yourself that. So, yeah. Yeah.
Look, I can't juggling that, being married, having and having a child. Not that, I mean, I have a child, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And trying to, it's hard. It's
probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. All right. Well, thank you for joining us here on POSCOM Prevention Talks.
We always like to say, and especially to you, Tansy, thank you for namasteing, but now I'm a go.